did it without thinking. I don't know what I hoped to accomplish. Perhaps it was just to see him, to remind him of his brothers and sisters, to look over the circumstances. Maybe he wouldn't have been home, or maybe it would have set his father off in some way that... Let's just find him. Then take it from there. We've both got a pretty good idea how he's living, and as far as the courts go, it wouldn't stack up against the home we could give him. You're doing a fine job with Jesse and Pooh. It's been good trying to be their daddy. I could never have kids. And when you think about the road I've been down, that's probably the best. I try to do right by Dooley, too. But I know he looks on you as his dad, and I'd never want to mess with that. The first time I saw him is etched in my memory like an engraving. A little red-headed guy with freckles, mad at the world, old before his time. It hasn't been easy, but it's been rich, and I'm thankful. I admit I'm real uneasy about what could come of this. Dooley's afraid it could be a powder keg. But I've been praying about finding the boys since we got married. So has Pauline. And I know you're praying. Have been, will be. So, Buck finished his coffee and set the cup down firmly. Why don't you and me plan a time to run down the mountain? I'd like to start from scratch with Pink Shuford and his buddy. Father Tim! He turned and saw Father Talbot trotting toward him from Happy Endings in his running gear. Wait up! It wasn't easy, thought Father Tim, to have been succeeded at Lord's Chapel by a man who, though only a few years younger, had all his hair, ran daily, worked out, used a rowing machine, and wore top-of-the-line Nikes. Henry, glad to see you. And he was glad. Just going down to the office to ring you, said Henry Talbot, huffing. You're looking terrific, very trim and fit. In truth, he was so drained that he was headed home instead of to Sweet Stuff for fruit tarts. Pushing along very well, thanks. How are you and Mary getting on? Planning our trip to the Bahamas for 10 days, a surprise anniversary gift from our kids. I'm hoping you can supply for me at Lord's Chapel next month. Let's see. Henry Talbot fetched a small planner from the pocket of his running shorts and flipped the pages. The 8th and 15th. It would make a lot of people happy, I dare say. Lord's Chapel. Something like fear pierced his heart. Was he rusty? Was he up to it? Yes, he said. I'd like nothing better. Hesse Mayhew dodged into the handkerchief garden between the collar button and the Sweet Stuff bakery and stood, frozen, by a bit of dahlias, hoping Father Tim would not spot her as he passed. She clutched a brass vase chock-full of multiflora roses that she'd just cut from her arbor and was taking to the office building next door to Sweet Stuff. It was a $40 arrangement and worth every dime, but she suddenly felt like a common criminal. To think of all he'd been through, and now at last he was out and about, no doubt to pay tribute to those who'd sent food and flowers through the long weeks, while the absence of a single solitary word from Hesse Mayhew pained him like a sore and festering thumb. "Good morning, Hesse." She turned, humiliated, and looked into his beaming face. "It's great to see you, Hesse. How are you?" Unthinking, she hastily closed the distance between them and thrust the vase of roses into his hands. "There!" she blurted, sloshing water onto his shirt sleeve. Appalled at her grossly inept presentation, she turned and fled along the sidewalk. Since he was standing at the door of Sweet Stuff, he decided to go in. It would, at the very least, be a place to sit for a few minutes before he began the long trek home. The vase of flowers seemed to weigh more than he would have thought. He went inside, thumped the vase onto a table, and sat. "Water," he said to Winnie, who gave him a concerned look. "Where's your car, darling?"
"Ah," he said, "my car."
"Yes, you know, the red Mustang with the rag top, the leather seats, oh, that car."
"Blast.
Parked in front of the grill." He thrust the vase into her hands. "There," he said, not knowing what else to say.
"Oh, my! Lovely!"
"Happy birthday," he said, recovering his wits. She set the vase on the coffee table before the sofa.
"Perfect! What a wonderful shade of pink! Thank you, dearest."
She plucked a small envelope from among the roses and smiled.
"Let's see what tender sentiment you've inscribed to me."
He lifted his hands helplessly. He hadn't seen an envelope. She withdrew a small card and peered at it.
"Happy retirement, Mildred," she read aloud. "Old bookkeepers never die. They just nickel and dime the rest of us to death. Timothy, what on earth?"
"Joke," he said feebly. However, as the joke was on him, he told her the truth and was vastly relieved when she howled with laughter. He lay across the bed, remembering what else he'd forgotten. The fruit tarts. The promised visit to Bill and Rachel. Voices floated up from downstairs. 3 o'clock. He must have fallen asleep after lunch. He was slightly disoriented. The morning had seemed an entire day in itself. Maybe he should see Hoppy tomorrow. But no, tomorrow was full. He sat up on the side of the bed and gazed at the floor, unseeing. "Timothy?"
"Yes."
Cynthia stood in the doorway. The blanched look on her face alarmed him. "Harley just brought this over." She walked to the bed and handed him a sheet of paper. "For labor and parts," he read aloud, $168. "For Miss Pringle's car. Harley said you told him to repair the brakes and gas gauge, and that you'd pay the bill." The tone of her voice made his heart beat heavily.
"Come and sit down," he said.
"I'm perfectly fine standing up." He said you noticed her car needed work when she drove you down the mountain while I was away.
He hadn't told his wife everything. He had postponed the truth. He would definitely be paying his dues.
The pain he'd experienced over the last terrible weeks had been a dull pain. This suffering was sharp and hard. He looked at the closed door of her workroom. He had seldom ever seen this door closed. In both cases, he'd hurt someone through selfish neglect. The accident had occurred because he'd neglected to follow doctor's orders. He'd hurt his wife by neglecting to share the simple truth of what he'd done. Helene Pringle had made a gesture of sacrifice for him, and in return he'd tried to do something he knew she needed and couldn't easily afford. It hadn't occurred to him that this act of gratitude might be a breach of Cynthia's trust. It was as if the earth had disappeared beneath him, and he was falling through a space both vast and cold. "Words cannot express the sorrow I feel for having..." He put the pen down and stared into Baxter Park. This was his wife's birthday, the day he was to take her into this very park for a picnic, and give her the gift he'd planned so carefully all those months ago. They could not utterly lose this day. It was too important. Indeed, it was crucial. One must not lose the day that belongs so especially to a loved one. Birthdays must not be tossed about by every ill wind that blows. He looked at his watch. 4:45. He had 30 minutes to throw himself on her mercy and get this show on the road.
"Here you go," said Avis Packard, wearing an apron imprinted with the green local logo. Father Tim stood at the front door and held out his arms to receive the picnic basket, packed to the brim.
"Tell me what you think. Maybe I'll offer this as a regular deal. Maybe have a banner printed, 1st-class picnics, fresh daily. What do you think?"
"I think it'll work," he said, backing away from the door. Avis was a talker, and he didn't have all day.
"A nice touch for honeymoons, anniversaries, or just taking the old buggy for a spin on the parkway. Pull off to an overlook with your honey, roll out this basket, and—"
Avis rubbed his hands together, grinning.
"You're a marketing genius," said Father Tim, closing the door to within an inch of the jamb.
"Thanks for the personal delivery. Put it on my tab." "The goat cheese is from France," said Avis, peering through the crack. "Not the valley. I thought for your special occasion you'd want the French."
"Right. Thanks a million." He closed the door. Avis knocked. He opened the door.
"Your champagne—"
"What about it?"
"It's from Champagne, France. The real thing. You said do whatever it takes. And, oh, yeah, happy—what is it, anniversary?"
"Birthday," he said. "Got to run."
"I'm having a birthday next week. Guess how old?"
"Catch you later," he said, closing the door.
"Cynthia," he implored, standing at the door to her workroom, "I have something important to say."
She opened the door and looked at him, calm, unruffled.
"Will you come out to our garden bench?" he asked. He gave her his arm. As she took it, his heart leaped with gratitude.
"When I asked you to marry me," he said, "I failed to do all that you deserved." He stood before her, ashamed and naked in his regret. "When I asked you to marry me, I went down on one knee. My very soul knew it wasn't enough. But in those days, I didn't heed my soul the way you've taught me to do. I heed it now." He sank to one knee, then the other, and took her hands in both of his. "Forgive me, please, for shutting you out. I was going to tell you everything. I vow that I was." He saw a certain light return to her eyes, the light he had lived by, the light he could not bear to lose. Helene remarked that she'd seen Dooley at the drugstore in Holding, and something in me knew it might be one of the boys. I didn't have the strength to drive down the mountain, and she offered to take me. It was the most urgent thing I'd done in a long time. I had to go. I wanted to see whether it might be. He swallowed down a lump. "We've all waited so long and prayed so fervently."
"Yes," she said.
"And so we went. And it was a wild goose chase. And Helene's car had very bad brakes. I tell you, I was scared out of my wits, the way she careened around the curves."
She looked at him, silent.
"And her gas gauge wasn't working. We might have run out of gas in the middle of nowhere. Believe me, this was nowhere."
"I believe you," she said quietly.
"There is absolutely nothing between Helene Pringle and myself, except a mutual respect. Having her mother at Hope House is a considerable expense. I dare say she couldn't afford the work on her car. I didn't think twice about asking Harley to do it.
she'd gone out of her way for me. I feel certain she helped us find Sammy. He looked at her, imploring. She's a kind neighbor, nothing more. Yes, she said. Do you believe that? I have always believed that, and ever shall. I don't mind so much that you went down the mountain with another woman, or even that you footed the bill to have her crankcase greased. Her brakes. It was her brakes. Brakes, then. What I mind very, very much indeed is that you didn't tell me. And such good news that you've found Sammy. But nothing, not a word to me. I'm more than a little sensitive, Timothy. Remember that I was married to someone who enjoyed the company of other women, and in the end, he chose them over me. The leaves of the dogwood by the bench murmured in a light breeze. These last weeks haven't been easy. You've been so silent and dark, so unlike yourself. It has frightened me terribly to see you this way, to feel you might be moving away from me, drifting towards some other purpose. Never, he said, stricken that she would think this. She patted the bench beside her. Come and sit, darling. His legs were beginning to notice what he'd done. They were as numb as tinned mackerel. Not until I get what I'm down here for. And what is that? Your forgiveness. He was the blind beggar. He was the lame man at the pool called Beautiful. He was the woman with the issue of blood. She gazed at him fondly, then leaned over and kissed his forehead. There, dearest. I'm sorry I fretted so. I love you with all my heart. I love you back with all of mine. Of course I forgive you, she said. He looked into her eyes and found what he was seeking. Happy birthday, sweetheart. She laughed and stood and held out her hands to him. He grasped them, noting that he couldn't have gotten up without her help. They had dined. They had toasted her nativity. They had lolled on the quilt in Baxter Park like rustics. Hurry, he said, before we lose the light. He took the box from under the park bench and handed it over. It was wrapped in blue paper and tied with raffia he'd found on her potting table. She placed it in her lap, beaming. I ordered it months ago. It was made just for you. He could hardly wait to see her face. He was nearly bursting with anticipation and relief. She tore the paper off. His wife was not one to iron and save wrapping paper, and twined the raffia in her hair, laughing. She lifted the lid of the box that enclosed her gift, and found another box. Her initials, inlaid into the warm olive wood in brass, gleamed in the twilight. She was hushed and silent. "Look inside," he said, touching her shoulder. She lifted the hinged lid and saw fat pastel sticks fitted into the box, row upon row, indigo, violet, ultramarine, cobalt, yellow ochre, vermilion, carmine, purple, and all the hues in between. Timothy! His chipper and talkative wife could barely speak. The box is from Italy. It was made by Roberto's close friend Marcello, from Olivewood. Roberto included something wonderful in this little compartment. Lift the pull. She lifted the small brass pull and peered inside the Lilliputian box within the box. Seven of his grandfather Leonardo's pastelli, he said. Leonardo was the boy who helped paint the angel ceiling at Fernbank when Miss Sadie was a child. Roberto sends these with love. He found his wife's tears of joy an odd pleasure, rather than the fright they'd been during their courtship. "There," he said, holding her in his arms. "You once said you'd like to try pastels." "You are the dearest man I've ever known. There is none dearer than thee." "Regrettably, I'm vastly handicapped by selfishness." "There's a gift I'd like you to give me." She looked at him and smoothed the hair over his left ear. "Anything, Timothy?" "I want you to go on the literacy tour." There, he'd said it, and his heart did not wrench. In truth, as the words came out of his mouth, a certain peace flooded in. Uncle Billy Watson stood at the bathroom mirror, raking his bushy gray eyebrows with his wife's pocket comb, and faced the terrible truth. He couldn't make up a joke if his life depended on it. Every time he tried, he fell off to sleep and woke up with a blooming crick in his neck. If he couldn't find a joke over at the grill today, it looked like the preacher was going to have to make his own self laugh. Puny had brought the girls this morning, as she was working only a half day. He was sitting in the study with his prayer book when Sassy came in and thumped down beside him. She nestled into the crook of his right arm. "What's wrong, Grandpa?"
"Wrong? Is something wrong?"
"You're sad. Is it 'cause Miss Cynthy's going off on a trip round the world?"
"No, no, not around the world. Around the country."
"That's the same thing."
"Yes," he said. "Yes, you're right."
He was at Sweet Stuff soon after it opened to buy a half dozen fruit tarts. Then he walked to his car and zoomed up the steep hill to the Sprouse place, where, his nerves alarmed by the prospect of what lay ahead, he had a cup of coffee with Bill and Rachel, prayed with Bill, laughed his head off at Sparky's replacement, and felt immeasurably better when he said goodbye an hour later. The hall was illumined only by a gray light from the windows on the street front. Father Tim walked with Buck Leaper to the pool table. "Mr. Shuford, I believe you have something that belongs to me." Pink Shuford didn't look up. He knifed himself over the rim of the table and studied a shot.
"What's that?"
$38.
"Make me laugh, preacher. Can I help it? Your broke-down car couldn't keep up."
"Right," said Bug Austin from the other end of the table.
"You lost us, which was clearly your intention."
"Law help, Bug. You recall how we had to hold back to keep 'em behind us?"
Buck moved within inches of Pink Shuford and stood silent until Pink looked up.
"I don't understand why we have to discuss this particular issue," said Buck. "Father Cavanaugh paid you to do something you didn't do. You can give him his money back, or you can lead us to Sammy Barlow. Take your pick."
Buck Leaper was a big man, a very big man. His whole physique spoke of physical power. Father Tim saw that Pink Shuford noted this fact.
"Clyde Barlow, he's got some bad dogs back in there, ain't he, Bug?"
"Bad dogs don't mess with me," said Buck.
Pink turned away and chalked his cue.
"I can see you and your friend here have all day."
Buck nonchalantly rolled up one shirt sleeve, then the other.
"But we don't."
Pink Shuford appeared distinctly pained.
"If you ever say I run you out there, I'll say you lied." "Where you parked at?"
"Right behind your truck, ready to roll," said Buck. "By the way, you wouldn't want to pull the same trick again.
Right, said Pink. No problem.
Father Tim felt a definite surge of adrenaline. While bad dogs might not mess with Buck, they'd sure messed with yours truly a time or two. At the age of 9, he'd been badly bitten on the ankle. However, with God in control, and Buck Leaper second in command, he figured the odds were definitely improved over his last trip down the mountain.
Chapter 13 Sammy.
They followed the truck along a state highway, then veered left onto a gravel lane that ran by the wayside pulpit of Shady Grove Chapel. Don't wait for 6 strong men to take you to church. Father Tim uncapped a bottle of water and peered at the landscape. This is a different road.
It better be the right road, said Buck. If Shuford don't deliver this time, I'll wrap that tattoo around his neck.
Father Tim took a swig of the water with one hand, and with the other gripped the handle above the passenger door. Pink Shuford was moving, no two ways about it, and Buck was hammering down on the blue truck's rear bumper. In the absence of air conditioning, the windows of Buck's red pickup were cranked open, and they were taking on the dust of creation. The gravel track was now running beside a shallow river. Its banks rose steeply from a stream bed that was randomly paved with large boulders. Gnarled vines knit an intricate web among the trees.
"Spooky," said Buck.
"How far have we come from town?"
12 miles. By the way, don't worry. I won't wrap Shuford's tattoo around his neck.
Buck grinned.
"But he don't know that I won't."
They saw an abandoned farm building with a collapsed roof, then a derelict house overgrown with honeysuckle. At the end of a rutted drive, a dog sat by an open mailbox, panting. Father Tim could no longer ignore the headache that had started in the pool hall. It throbbed in his temples like a hammer. The blue truck braked so suddenly that Buck swerved off the road. He leaned out the window and shouted, "What's the deal?" Pink Shuford made a U-turn, heading his truck the way they'd come in. Bugs sat in the cab as Pink got out, chewing a toothpick.
"That's it over yonder."
Pink gestured toward a house trailer set back from the opposite bank of the river. 2 pairs of pants hung on a clothesline between the house and a nearly empty woodshed. A chicken scratched in the dust. Father Tim and Buck got out of the truck.
"How do we know that's it?" asked Buck.
"You asked me to bring you out here. That's what I done. I ain't got papers to prove whose house it is."
"Is Barlow home? I don't see a car."
"They ain't got a car."
"How does the boy get to town from out here?" asked Father Tim.
"Hitches a ride with Lon Birdie.
Whatever."
"Does he go to school?"
Pink shrugged.
"I don't keep up with his personal life."
"Does he go to town often?"
"A good bit."
"What does he do at the pool hall?"
"Shoots pool."
"He's underage."
"That ain't my problem."
Buck shaded his eyes and looked across the river. "I don't see anybody over there," he said to Pink.
"So? Somebody being there wasn't in the deal."
"How does Clyde Barlow make a living?"
"He don't make a living. He gets a check from the government. Plus Sammy's a sharp little pool shooter. He wins enough to help out with a few rations, his daddy's liquor, whatever. Course, he don't win nothing off of me."
Pink grinned, hanging his thumbs in the loops of his jeans.
"Where's the bridge?"
"A little ways down and make a right. It's a hanging bridge. You can't take a vehicle on it."
Someone appeared in the doorway of the house. The distance was great enough that Father Tim couldn't distinguish much more than a blue shirt.
"That's Clyde right yonder," said Pink. "We can see him better than he can see us. He's blind in one eye. Can't hear too good neither."
Pink spit the toothpick on the ground.
That toothpick ain't getting it.
Any chance of bumming a cigarette?
I quit that foolishness, said Buck.
So look, if y'all got what you come after, me and Bug are headed back to town.
Pink extended his hand, palm up.
I don't reckon you'd like to buy a man and his buddy a cold beer.
Nope, said Buck. I wouldn't. Thanks for the ride.
Seem like for running y'all out this way twice, $38 ain't much. You'd have paid more for a cab.
When you took the father on a wild goose chase, I figure you were on your way home anyway, so that's no charge. Today'll be 24 miles round trip at 34.5 cents a mile government allowance, which amounts to $8 and change. This leaves $30 for an hour of your time. I call that good money.
Pink's laugh was raucous.
You're a pretty cool dude. Maybe I'll shoot you a game one of these days. By the way, preacher, you don't believe that old mess about God being real, do you?
I know he's real.
How do you know?
I was talking to him this morning. Pink took a step back, laughed again, and walked quickly to the blue truck. He got in, gunned the motor, let out the clutch, and scratched off, the tires digging into the red clay of the riverbank. They watched the truck disappear around a bend, then turned, silent, and gazed across the river.
"You looking for clean jokes or the other kind?"
the truck driver asked Uncle Billy. He lifted the top off his burger and removed the sliced tomato, added pickles and a dollop of fries, shook ketchup over the revision, replaced the top of the bun, and mashed down the whole caboodle.
"Clean," said Uncle Billy. "That's all the kind I tell. Besides, they're for a preacher."
"They's some preachers is like the other kind."
"Not this preacher," said the old man. "I got your wife jokes, your in-law jokes, your school teacher jokes."
The driver took a generous bite of his burger.
"Then there's your preacher jokes, which might be a good idea under the circumstances."
Uncle Billy was dumbfounded at his good fortune. All he'd done was climb on a stool at the grill, strike up a conversation with a trucker making a run to Greensboro, and look here.
"Plus I got your doctor jokes, your lawyer jokes, your cab driver jokes. I'll be et for a tater," said Uncle Billy. "I don't hardly know where to start at."
He thought the good Lord must somehow be in on this.
"I got an old maid joke that's pretty funny." "It's clean, is it?"
"Clean,"
said the driver, hammering down on his burger.
"Well, sir,"
Uncle Billy felt light-headed. All these years scrambling around for jokes, and right here at a feller's elbow sat the joke king himself. This called for a celebration. He felt carefully in his left pants pocket and located the 20, then looked up and caught Percy's eye.
"I'll take a order of chicken fingers with your honey mustard dip," he called in a loud voice.
It had been a long time since he'd sat on a stool and ordered like a man.
"And give me a Pepsi Cola with that."
Hope Winchester jumped as if a shot had been fired. "Excuse me, Miss Winchester." She turned quickly and blurted, "Call me Hope." "Hope," he said, smiling. He stooped and picked up the book he'd just dropped. "Grey's Anatomy. No harm done." She hadn't meant to say what she'd just said. She'd planned to say it when they were conversing quietly about poetry, or even the nuances of mail order. "The 13th edition before the revision?" She strained to appear casual. "Yes, I'll be more careful."
"I find you very careful, Mr. Gaynor. You handle books as if they were infants."
"Please call me George. No one has called me Mr. Gaynor since I taught economics."
George. Saying his given name seemed alarmingly intimate. She colored deeply and turned away, reaching for the book lying open beside the register. Her aim was awkward, and the book crashed to the floor. She was humiliated. She had twice dropped a book in front of him, and of course he had just dropped a book. Was there some epidemic of the nervous system passing through Mitford? He walked over and picked it up and handed it to her. "Thank you," she whispered. She knew she could no longer bear the crushing fear and attraction she felt, and the terrible conflict between the two. Hesse Mayhew parked in the no-parking zone at Mitford Hospital and took the elevator to the second-floor nurse's station. Her cargo was destined for Minnie Lauder, who had just undergone a kidney operation and turned 84, all in the same day. She gave the basket a last once-over, critiquing the simple harmony of periwinkle, cinnamon fern, moss from which a tiny red mushroom was growing, and a real bird's nest that she'd plucked from a pot of ivy after the wrens had flown. "Oh," said Nurse Kennedy. "Beautiful. You've done it again, Hesse." "It could use more color," Hesse said sternly. "Oh, nonsense. You're too hard on yourself. But, of course, nothing measures up to the basket you gave Father Tim when he was with us." "The basket?" "Yes, it was just glorious, and as big as Johnson County." Nurse Kennedy would never have confessed that Father Tim had given the basket to her, and that she'd planted everything in it around her bird bath. Hesse thumped the basket down at the nurse's station. "Minnie Lauder, 206, she proclaimed in a loud voice. Then, mad as a wet hen, she turned and hot-footed it to the elevator. "Don't move," said Father Tim. The pounding of his heart nearly took his breath away. "Look there." They watched the tall, barefoot boy come along the riverbed, walking on boulders that inlaid the stream. Sunshine filtered through the canopy of trees overhanging the water. As he stepped into a patch of light, Sammy Barlow's hair blazed like a coronet of fire. They had walked to the bridge, crossed over, and come along a path by a pine wood to their left. They paused when they approached the clearing where the Barlow trailer sat on an underpinning of concrete blocks. A dog limped toward them with its tail between its legs. Father Tim judged it to be a member of the hound family. He could easily have counted its ribs.
"If that's a bad dog, I'll eat a billy goat," said Buck.
Father Tim reached into his shirt pocket and withdrew the rest of the granola bar his wife had sent on this mission. He unwrapped it and laid it by the root of a white oak at the edge of the yard. "Good fellow," he said, as the dog devoured it and sniffed for crumbs.
"Are you ready?" asked Buck.
"Ready, and praying there won't be any guns in this encounter." He was also praying that his headache would ease off. It was the worst he could remember.
"A man with a dog like that probably don't keep a gun."
"I'd stop right there if I was you." Both men jumped, startled by the voice from the shadow of the woods. Peering into the pine grove, they saw the boy standing by a large outcropping of rock.
"We're looking for Sammy Barlow," Buck said.
"You ain't going to find him. He's done moved off to Statesville and ain't coming back."
Father Tim looked into the face of a younger Dooley Barlow and knew he must make an effort to keep his voice calm. "But you're Sammy, of course."
"No, I ain't. And you better get out of here right now. This is private property."
The dog sniffed Father Tim's pant legs. "We've come to talk with you about your brothers and little sister."
Sammy uttered Dooley's once favorite four-letter word.
"I ain't got no brothers and sisters."
Had Pink led them on another wild goose chase? No. This was Dooley Barlow's blood kin, freckles and all. Nothing in him doubted it.
"Jesse doesn't remember you," said Buck. "But Pooh does, and Dooley. They really want to see you."
"I'm going to bash your heads in if you don't get on."
Sammy picked up a stick and brandished it.
"You remember Dooley," said Father Tim. "He took care of you that time you were so sick with the flu. He gave you his best jacket to wear to school and put a dollar in the pocket. You remember?"
He was piecing together fragments of stories Dooley had told him. They didn't amount to much, but it was the best he could do. He walked closer to the patch of woods, to the narrow path that led into the cool chiaroscuro shade. Even from this distance, he saw the anger and fear in the boy's eyes. He thought he also saw something else, a kind of hope or longing.
And Dooley was saying how, "Come another step, and you'll fall in a nest of rattlers big as your arm."
"Right," said Buck. And Jessie was saying how, if she could see her brother Sammy, she'd give him all the money she's saved and make him scrambled eggs every morning. Jessie makes fine scrambled eggs.
"I've got a shotgun hid under this rock. I'll blow your brains out if you don't get back where you come from."
"She likes to crumble up liver mush in her scrambled eggs," said Buck. "The same as your granddaddy, Russell Jacks, likes to do."
"We've got pictures to show you," said Father Tim, reaching into his jacket pocket. Sammy's confusion was visible. He appeared ready to turn and run. Instead, he stood his ground as if frozen.
"Sometimes," said Buck, "Jessie sets a place at the table for you. She turned 10 years old last week."
They were walking into the woods now, toward the rock, toward the boy with the blanched and stricken face. Without looking at each other or exchanging a word, the two men knew they had to show Sammy these pictures. It was crucial. Father Tim wondered if there might really be a shotgun, but something in him doubted it. He felt a kind of eagerness about walking into the wood. It had to be done. He smiled at Sammy, though it was Dooley he saw in this thin boy with the scar on his cheek and the lank red hair pulled into a ponytail. He stood aside to let Buck walk ahead of him on the narrow path and reminded himself to keep talking. "Dooley dreams about you, Sammy. He saved his first bicycle for you." Sammy didn't move. He was listening now. He was trying not to, Father Tim observed, but he was listening, waiting, letting them come in. Buck drew the pictures from his pocket. Father Tim did the same. "Be with us, Lord. Send your Holy Spirit." As they approached the rock, he looked directly into Sammy's eyes. The joy this gave him was indescribable. He wanted to throw his arms around the boy and shout, but restrained any show of feeling. They were walking on eggs. "Stay calm, stay cool." He laid the pictures on the rock, silent. Buck followed suit, fanning the snapshots like a hand of cards. They had run the bases. They were nearly home.
"That's Pooh. He's 11, said Buck, keeping his voice casual. "His school picture. He made an A in geography. I never even knew where Idaho was when I was in school. This is him with his new bat. He can hit a softball all the way to Tennessee. And this is him on his bike."
Buck breathed deeply, as if he'd held his breath for a long time.
"And this is Jessie, her last school picture.
She's 10.
Father Tim felt the hard knot in his throat. This was a type of miracle, and he was standing in the midst of it. He pointed to a picture of Dooley and Cynthia sitting on the front steps of the yellow house. "This is Dooley," he said. "He's 19. Father Tim watched Sammy Barlow resist the depth and power of his feelings. Sammy was doing what Dooley had always done, hardening his face into a mask, a stone. Only his eyes betrayed the depth of his longing to examine the images spread before him. Sammy stepped back from the rock.
"You'uns better get out of here. When my paw sees you hanging around, you'll be skinned."
Buck grinned. "It'd take a while to skin me. He probably don't have time to complete the job."
Father Tim realized his adrenaline had been pumping hard all morning. Exhaustion was sweeping through him in a wave. His vision suddenly blurred, then cleared. In that moment, the exhaustion vanished, taking his headache with it. "Ah," he said aloud, amazed and grateful. The place where they stood became abruptly vivid. He hadn't looked about him until now. It was wondrously cool in this light and shade-dappled copse. Indeed, they were standing in a garden.
"Lady Slipper," said Father Tim. "And by heaven, look there! Jack in the Pulpit!"
Though the blossom had gone, he recognized the leaves.
"Stay on the path," commanded the boy. "Watch where you're stepping."
"Of course, I'm sorry. And there's trillium, a whole grove. Is the bloom white or pink?" Sammy hesitated a long moment.
"White,"
he said. Father Tim heard water rushing along the nearby riverbed, the first time he'd heard it since they crossed the bridge. These lovely things surely didn't grow here in the same patch.
"I dug some in the woods over yonder."
In a space hardly bigger than Cynthia's workroom, and carpeted with black loam and leaf mold, was a remarkable variety of wild plants. Tall ferns with furred fiddleheads, a colony of silvery Dutchman's pipe that lit the wood's floor like small candles, a grove of mayapple. Father Tim squatted down and peered beneath the leaves of a plant where rows of onyx berries hung like necklaces. "Solomon's seal?" he asked, looking up at Sammy.
"It's common," said Sammy. "Not different like some of the others, but it grows good and gives cover to the jacks."
"And these pink lady slippers," said Father Tim. "I've never seen so many in one place."
"They was already growing in here, in a bunch. It give me the idea to..."
Sammy glanced around.
"Do this."
"Is that a yellow slipper over there?"
"Yeah, there's 5 kinds of slipper. This is the only yeller I ever found. There's a yeller and white, too, but Lon Birdie says it don't grow except out west summers."
"What a blessing to all this," said Father Tim, smiling up at the boy. "A blessing." Sammy's grandfather, Russell Jacks, had been the finest gardener Lord's Chapel had ever hired. "I believe the slipper is in the orchid family." He was feeling like a new man, light of spirit, the headache vanished.
"Lon Birdie was in a jungle in Nam, where he's seen plenty of orchids. He says there's 2 million kinds of orchids."
"And that purplish leaf, let's see, I can't think of the name."
"Galax. I didn't dig that. It was already grown over there, but I've got to take some of it out. It's forceful."
Father Tim squatted for a moment more, then stood,
his knees creaking like rusted gates. Something had just happened in here. Quite a lot had happened. "This is a private place, isn't it, Sammy?" The boy lowered his eyes and shrugged. "Thanks for letting us come in."
"Yeah," said Buck, clearing his throat. "Thanks."
"Let me say that last and back to make sure I learned it right."
"Take your time,"
said the trucker, who had just ordered apple pie a la mode.
"This is a easy run. Nothing perishable like last week when I was hauling cantaloupes to Pennsylvania."
Uncle Billy cleared his throat.
"Woman went to the new dock, don't you know. He was so young, he was hardly a shaven. Well, sir, she was in there a couple of minutes, when all at once she busted out a hollering and run down the hall."
Uncle Billy paused.
"You got it," said the trucker. "Keep going."
"Well, sir, a doc that was a good bit older took off after her, said, 'What's the problem?' And she told him. The old doc went back to the young doc, said, 'What's the dad jing matter with you? Miss Perry is 65, a-going on 66, with 4 growed children and 7 grands, and you told her she was a-going to have a young'un?'
New doc grinned, don't you know, said, 'Cured her hiccups, didn't it?'"
Uncle Billy knew when a joke hadn't gone over, and this one hadn't gone over. Not even with the person he'd gotten it from in the first place. The trucker gazed thoughtfully at his reflection in the chrome napkin dispenser.
"Seemed like it was funny when I heard it the first time, but now it might be what you call..."
He shrugged.
"Flat,"
said Uncle Billy, feeling the same way himself.
"I'd advise you to exit,"
said the trucker, digging into his apple pie.
"Start off with your 2 guys on a bench, slide in with your cab driver joke, and land you a 1-2 punch with the old maids."
Uncle Billy wished he had some kind of guarantee this particular lineup would work. Chapter 14 Waiting for Wings. As families around Mitford waked and stirred, more than a few wondered what last night's violent storm might have done to the valley corn crop. Second only in importance to the town's Independence Day parade was the season's first delivery of Silver Queen corn, expected to arrive any moment at the local. After hearing a weather bulletin, niece Simmons and his wife and 4 children had picked corn until 2 o'clock in the morning before the storm broke over the valley at 3 a.m. Working by torch and flashlight, they loaded their hasty harvest in the farm truck and backed it into the barn in the nick of time. From 3 until 7, the storm dumped 5 inches of precipitation into the valley below Mitford, washing out large crops of potatoes, cantaloupes, and strawberries, all destined for sale at the local. This devastation caused the Simmons family to worry whether their prayers for rain had been too fervent. Niece told his wife, Veda, that he would make a point of discussing it with their preacher to see whether any of the blame for crop loss might in fact lie squarely on the shoulders of the Simmonses. "Hush and go to sleep," she said, patting his hand. "The Lord knows what he's doing." "Will you ride up with me tomorrow?" he asked. "If I'm not too give out," she said. On the way to the airport, Father Tim passed niece and Veda Simmons, driving into Mitford, as he and Cynthia drove out. Both parties threw up a hand in greeting. "There's our corn," said Father Tim. It would be a big day in Mitford. By 1 o'clock, every ear would be emptied from the bins on Main Street. And by 6 o'clock, the lot of it would be boiling on village stoves, his own included. But his wife wouldn't be here to enjoy it with him. For 2 weeks, she would be touring the world, and he was the one who'd encouraged her to do it. The truth was, she needed a chance to relish the fruits of her labors, to see the rapt faces of the children for whom she'd written and painted with such passion for so many years. And there was a further truth, one they hadn't talked about, one that he'd hidden in his heart so carefully he hardly knew it himself. He needed time. Time for what? To somehow get his act together, to work on his essays, and pitch in with George and Harley to build bookcases in the hallway, and maybe a cabinet for her illustrations. Just a little time, that's all he needed, and he would once again be himself. For weeks on end, he'd been a swimmer sinking to the pond bottom, with his brave wife struggling to pull him ashore. He'd been a heaviness to her, though she'd never said it. Indeed, she may not even have known it. But he'd known it, for he'd seen it in her face and heard it in her voice. If he were half the man he'd like to be, they'd be driving to the airport on their way to Venice or Tuscany or one of those other places she might love to go, even their honeymoon cottage in Maine, for heaven's sake. But he was not that man, and there was no use thinking he would one day become that man. He was the worst bump on a log ever given breath. He swallowed until the knot in his throat disappeared. "I'm not going to cry," he said, taking her hand. The tears were streaming down her cheeks, though they were scarcely beyond the town limits. "Thank you, dearest. I'm so sorry I'll miss your sermons." "Rats in a poke," he said, quoting one of her favorite epithets. "You've heard me preach 100 times, and I hope you'll hear me preach 100 more. I'll save you my notes, if I use any." She looked at him, smiling. "Promise me something." "Anything," he said. "Don't put butter on your corn." "No butter on his corn?" "Use olive oil. It's better for your health." "No rest for the wicked," he sighed. She squeezed his hand and laughed through the tears. "And the righteous don't need none." His house was not a tomb, nor a crypt, after all. The very light may have gone from it, but puny Bradshaw Guthrie, his appointed guardian and watchdog, was doing her mightiest to make it shine. Dooley was coming to lunch, and they were having a feast fit for royals, nay, for the heavenly hosts. "Alleluia," he declared to Puny, who wiped her face with her apron as she stood at the stove. Not even the air conditioning could spare them from the furnace produced by roiling steam, sizzling grease, and the divine tumult of preparation in general. Their house help, also known as his non-legally adopted daughter, was frying chicken, making potato salad with scallions, bacon, and sour cream, cooking fresh cranberries with shavings of ginger root and orange peel, simmering a pot of creamed corn, deviling eggs with homemade mayonnaise, and rolling out biscuits on the countertop. A pitcher of sweet tea stood at the ready, covered with one end of a tea towel. His grandmother's heavy glass pitcher, filled with unsweetened tea, was covered by the other end. A 3-layer coconut cake, set square in the center of the kitchen island, reigned over the room next to a small vase of early apple-green hydrangea blossoms. Excited as a child, he went to the downstairs powder room and tested his sugar. The banquet being prepared for Dooley Barlow had none of the criminal restrictions required by the diabetic. Thus, lunch would be filled with landmines that he must circumnavigate as best he could. Even so, a man could die with happiness on a day like this and have nothing at all to regret. He'd discussed it in detail with Cynthia, and they'd agreed. Go straight to the point, but only after the cake.
So what do you think?
Good, said Dooley, looking up and grinning. Really good. The icing's great.
Tell Puny.
Yes, sir, I will.
Remember when you first came to bunk with me, and Puny dunked you in the tub?
Dooley grinned.
I remember.
She had to chase you around the house a time or two. I chased her back.
Father Tim laughed, aware that simply watching Dooley eat cake today would be among his happiest memories.
Dooley licked the icing off his fork.
I'd like to stay with you and Cynthia next summer.
Something like joy surged in him. We'd love nothing better. But be warned, it's pretty dull around here.
That's okay.
It seemed eons since Dooley had lived in their house, clattered up and down the stairs, sat at their table. They were silent for a moment.
How are things at Meadowgate? Still wanting to be a vet?
Yes, sir.
The acclamation was immediate and fervent.
We did a uterine torsion procedure on a llama yesterday.
A llama?
There's a llama farm in Wilson Creek.
What's a uterine torsion procedure?
Sometimes a llama, even a cow, will have a twisted or torsed uterus. That means the fetus can't pass through the birth canal. Doc Owen says most fetuses are in the left horn of the uterus.
Left horn?
The lamoid uterus has two horns. Doc Owen says most UTs are twisted in a clockwise direction, so the left horn flips over the right horn. It's really hard on the llama, and we had to work fast, so Doc Owen decided to do a plank in the flank.
A what?
We used a 2x5 board, put it into the flank of the llama, and Doc Owen told me to kneel on the plank right over the flank area. Then we used ropes looped around the front and hind legs and rolled her over. See, what we wanted to do is hold the fetus and uterus in place with the plank and roll her to kind of catch up to the uterus. That solved the whole thing.
It did?
Yes, sir. Her chrea is really beautiful.
He was stunned by this piece of completely incomprehensible information. Dooley Barlow must be a genius.
You're a genius, he said, gushing, proud, moved.
No, I ain't. I mean, aren't.
Dooley turned red.
Doc Owen is.
He didn't know when such seeming nonsense had made him so happy.
I'm so proud of you I could bust.
Dooley studied the geranium in a pot on the table.
So how's the social life out there in the sticks?
He loved to see his boy grin from ear to ear.
Not bad, I take it.
No, sir.
Uh-huh.
I'm going out with Reba Sanders.
Really?
Who is Reba Sanders?
A girl.
Glad to hear it.
Her dad's a farmer. They have 400 head of cattle. Angus crossed with Hereford. Her mom teaches fifth grade.
Maybe he should tell Dooley that the Harpers were coming home in a couple of days. Wouldn't he like to know how Lace liked the Oregon Trail?
Probably not.
Dooley hammered down on the remainder of his cake.
She's cool.
Reba?
Yes, sir.
The Jeep needs some work. Hal thinks it's the carburetor.
After lunch, we'll run over to the station and let Harley take a look.
Why don't you take a look with him? It's good to know what's going on with your vehicle.
He was a fine one to talk. He'd never peered under a car hood in his life, except to scratch his head momentarily before slamming the thing down again.
His heart was full, and so was the boy's. He sensed the quiet happiness between them. Yet he was about to change all that.
Surely it couldn't hurt to postpone his announcement a few minutes. Let the boy's meal digest, for heaven's sake.
So, tell me more about Reba.
Tall.
Lace was tall, if he was looking for tall. Dooley thought a moment.
Her hair's kind of brown. Or maybe blonde.
Good. Anything else?
I can't think of anything.
Getting quality information out of Dooley Barlow was right up there with squeezing blood from a turnip.
What are her interests? Motorcycles.
Motorcycles. What could he possibly say to that? He pushed ahead.
In what way, exactly, is she interested in motorcycles?
She rebuilds sport bikes to make money for college next year. Right now she's working on a Suzuki GSXR 1100. When she gets through, it'll do 160, just like it came out of the crate.
Dooley looked at his empty cake plate. Man, I'm killed.
I'm only half killed, but we'd both better hug Puny's neck. Dooley cackled.
I ain't hugging her neck.
I like it when you say ain't.
I can't believe you said that. You used to hate it when I said ain't.
I know. I only like it because you never say it anymore.